Okay, everyone, it's October 9th, 2023. So let's get started. First, let me say Rabbi Kelman is not here. You might come later. There's a big event in Toronto right now, a unity event, and we have about 40 or so less people than usual. And I'm sure there's many more such events going on, including in my town. Rabbi Kelman called me earlier today and asked me, did I want to do it tonight? And I said, I'm here and I could do it. And although obviously it wasn't an easy time, I don't even know how anyone was able to dance or anything like that. But look, Talmud Torah, we have to continue. And after watching the news, many of us have been glued to our computer screens. It's important to also take a break and do some of the things that Torah in Motion offers. I mean, this is obviously much harder than in previous wars. So those who can remember Yom Kippur, Lebanon, we're much more connected. I dare say that every single person here knows people or is personally involved. Many people who listen to us have children in the army now, have grandchildren in the army. We all know people. It's not like years ago where we all know people are living there and all their sons are in the army. And it's not just in Israel. My cousin's son got a text. He's in America with no plans to go back to Israel, but he did his service there. He got a text yesterday morning on his phone to return. They booked him a flight on El Al today, but he didn't want to wait because his unit was organizing. So he himself bought a ticket, Turkish Air. Turkish Air is one of the only airlines still flying to Israel. Flew to Istanbul and made it to Israel today. And he's in a serious combat unit. So we hope for the best. And it's hitting close to home. A kid that young man that was in my son's bunk in Moshavah for many years was killed today. And if any of you are Moshavah parents, you would have got the email or saw it on the Instagram, wherever it was, about that. But look, we need to we pray that everything is going to go properly and that civilization will defeat the barbarism that we haven't seen since Nazi Germany almost. We just like during the Nazi years, we had to continue learning. We're going to continue tonight. And okay, let me begin with some things I want to get to. We spoke about women studying Torah and Rav Soloveitchik's position, and I have some more things I want to say about that as well later, because I think Rav Soloveitchik's position has been distorted. And I thank Joel for calling my attention to this, but I don't think I'll get to that today. I want to mention another thing related to it, that when we were speaking all about women's Torah study, I thought of this as well. Let me introduce you to this individual, Rabbi Mordechai Savitsky, who was a Rav in Boston the exact same time Rav Soloveitchik was there. In fact, in many ways, he was an adversary of the Rav. Relationship was not so good, although I did hear from one of Rav Savitsky's sons that later on, the relationship did get better. In fact, when he published one of his Sfarim, Rav Soloveitchik was there at the Seuda, the party that they give for the Sefer. It's perhaps fitting that Rav Savitsky's son and Rav Soloveitchik's grandson are now joint Rosh Yeshiva at Torah Vadas. Actually, let me mute if I can mute if I see anyone. I got a text to mute. So let me go back to Rabbi Savitsky. Genius, a real genius. Age 17, 18, he's corresponding with the Rogatchover. And I mean, he's like one of these individuals who, for whatever reason, never really made it. It says in the Zohar that everything is dependent on mazel. Kol toi b'mazel. It says, and Rav Savitsky was, like I said, one of these figures that just never made it, even though his learning was of the highest level. And there are many people, well-known Rosh Yeshiva, who I don't think it'd be unfair for me to say don't approach him in levels of learning. Okay, so why do I bring this up? Because there's an individual named Morton Smith. I don't know if people have heard of him. He was a professor at Columbia, a scholar of the ancient Jewish history, Christian history. He's the one when Jacob Neusder was giving I mentioned this when we did the Lieberman classes. Remember, Lieberman's final publication was a review of Neusner's translation of the Yerushalmi, and he ended by saying he doesn't know whether it belongs like in the wastebasket. I forget his exact language. So as Neusner is speaking at, I think it was American Academy of Religion, Morton Smith walks around and is handing out copies of this to everyone. A real character and a controversial character because he published a book called The Secret Gospel, which he claims to have found in the Mar Saba Monastery in Israel, an epistle of Clement of Alexandria, which there's a great, it's missing now. No one can find it. And half the world thinks that it's authentic. It just has disappeared. And the other half thinks that Morton Smith forged it. So it's an incredible story. But Morton Smith, he has his letters. He's a fascinating figure. He was during World War II, he was in Palestine and he got a PhD at the Hebrew University. And he was actually quite friendly with Gershom Scholem, and they published his correspondence. And in his letters to Gershom Scholem, pages 31 to 32, what does he say? He says that he went with Rabbi William Bro I think Browdy or Broad, I'm not sure how he pronounced it, of Providence. By the way, he was a reform rabbi, but he went to Yeshivas Rebbetzin Elchanan when he was younger, and he was quite close to Belkin. But he says as follows: since my return from Greece, which took place only in September, I have been going with him to Boston to hear Rabbi Savitsky expound the Talmud. Since Savitsky, whenever he gets excited, bursts into Yiddish, I am now learning Yiddish. So one thing leads to another. So here we have. You know, we spoke about teaching women Torah. Rabbi Savitsky didn't have a problem, seems, with a non-Jew coming to his Gemara class each week, which I find quite incredible. We had a number of talks last week about the Beis HaLevi and his divorce. I want to tell you the first, what I believe is the first ref, because a lot of people are interested in this, the first reference to this story. It appears in Hamelitz from 1892, the 18th of May. And it tells a story a little bit different from the Rav. The way they tell us the story there is it had to do with some piyutim, what piyut to say, and that's the ver and that's the version that's found in the biography of the Beis HaLevi called Harisha Moshesheles Brisk by Karolinsky. Karolinsky also assumes that the Beis HaLevi's first father-in-law was Chabad. So he thinks that probably has something to do with it. And also he reports, I don't know the source of this, he doesn't give it, that the base that the base lady's father-in-law had a son, another son. Well, he's the son-in-law. He had a son who didn't like the base lady and would he turned the father-in-law against him. So that is of interest. Two more things. Oh, I checked, by the way, the Aruch HaShulchan doesn't say isn't Melamed Tzchus about saying together, like I said last week, Hallel. I was thinking of that when I said Hallel this week, but there is a sefer I have, and there's others from Kumavasar Tov by Rabbi Meir Isaacson. He's a rav in New York. He died, I don't know, 20 years ago maybe. If you look in volume 3, page 69, he records someone writing to him that there's Yeshnam Bate Kitfilo Bate Hasidim Shemin Hagam Shatzibur Omri Bahalo Hodu Hashem V'chulei Biachad Imashatz. So that apparently there's some Hasidim who would, just like the modern Orthodox used to do it, Hasidim did it also, and his whole tshuva, is this appropriate? Because it seems to go against the Gemara. That the Gemara has the whole responsive. Now, there's other things that go against the Gemara that Hasidim do, or not just Hasidim. I was in shul during the week, what was it, maybe Tuesday night, so between Mincha Maariv, the rabbi speaks about Shmini Atzeres. And he says that, you know, Shulchan Aruch, you have to sit in the Sukkah Shmini Atzeres. The Gemara says you have to sit, and he says, we're Shulchan Aruch Jews. But of course, the Hasidim are also religious Jews. They don't sit in the Sukkah. And Rashi, it seems, according to Sefer Pardes, as I recall, says he didn't sit. And this could be based on the Yerushalmi. So, well, there's been a lot of discussion on it. So just because it's in the Bavli, doesn't necessarily mean that everyone holds of it. And, yes, it does say absolutely in the Bavli that you have to sit in the sukkah on Shmini Atzeres, and yet we know the Hasidim, they're good Jews, they don't. And I know Rav Soloveitchik said, well, this is a minhag tos because they used to come to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe, there wasn't, sukkah wasn't big enough, so they didn't eat in the sukkah, therefore. And With all due respect to the Rav, that's not true. That's not why they were doing this. They have all sorts of reasons to do it. Okay, so maybe the Rav saying that's where the reason comes from. But I don't believe so, because like I said, you have Rishonim, we have testimony that they didn't do it. And at least the Hasidim, they do not give that as the reason. They don't say it's a Melamed Zchus. They provide actual reasons for it. So maybe the Rav is right that it began by this way, but it's not a Minhag Tos in their mind, like the Rav thought. Two more things I want to show you before we begin. I found an article by, actually, I didn't find it. Someone emailed it to me. I don't know her. I've heard of her. Sharona Margolin Halikman. Is that how you pronounce her last name? Should we update the Nachem prayer? And she gives the different, we spoke about that last class. I know Rabbi Kelman was very strong about that. And we asked about Rav Lichtenstein. So first she quotes Rav Ovadia Yosef was against changing the prayer. It was made by Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. It's not only the physical state of the city on a low level, but the religious level is on a low level. Now, what's the physical state? I guess the Temple Mount, that's what he says. She quotes Rav Aaron Lichtenstein recited the regular Nusach, but he removed these words. The city that grieves for the loss of its children, that has laid waste of its dwellings, robbed of its glory, desolate without inhabitants. Now, for all the terrible things we saw, these words definitely apply to Sderot and Ofakim and other places, by the way, Rahat, which is a Bedouin village, also suffered terribly. But Jerusalem, it doesn't apply to, and Rav Aaron did not recite that. And then she quotes here, as I recall, does she quote the Rav? The Rav, Rav Soloveitchik. I think she quotes him here. I thought she did. Maybe she doesn't. That he says that you have to interpret the words. Yes, that since the Beis Hamikdash is not built, that means the whole city of Jerusalem is regarded as destroyed. So when you read Nachem and it speaks about a city of destruction, don't take it literally. It doesn't mean the actual city. What it means, the Rav says, is that the city, I mean, Beis HaMikdash is not there, so it's as if the city is destroyed. And finally, the last thing I want to share with you today, and I thank Yehuda for sending this to me. This gets back to something we did, I think it was last semester, the semester before, about restaurants that are not under hashgacha that people ate at. And I told you, if you remember, in the last issue of Halacha in Contemporary Society, Rabbi Yonah Ries had a whole piece on this, and I challenged what he said because it's simply, he might be right about takanas today, but it's not in line with the history at all. And I spoke about the Pioneer Hotel, the hotel I worked at, Simcha Benassi. I went into it at length. So here we have a letter from Eli Feit. And let me just read it to you. He says as follows. He says, first of all, he thanks Rabbi Yonah Ries for this article. And the edict from the Beis Hillel of the 17th century that you need kosher certification. But then he says, I believe the following facts should be brought to the attention of your readership. Now, what he says, I didn't know. I didn't even hear of this hotel before, the Empire Hotel. Maybe some of you remember it. He says, in the mid to late 1960s, I worked as a waiter in the Catskill Mountains at the Empire Hotel in Ferndale, New York. The hotel was owned by Messrs. Herschel Nyman and Moshe Newman, who were individuals that were Shomrei Torah mitzvos. The Empire Hotel had no kosher certification from either a national kosher organization or a private label hashgacha. Moreover, I had the privilege of serving many prominent rabbonim that frequented the hotel, including Moshe Feinstein, and on occasion, individuals representing major national Orthodox Jewish organizations, which held their annual conventions there. Based on Rabbi Ries's excellent exposition and analysis of the halacha on the subject, I assume there are Moshe and others were relying on the owners of the hotel as being mussar b'kashrus, and otherwise following the less stringent view outlined by the poskim. By the way, I'll get back to this, because Ramosha was not following the less stringent view at all. These are my personal assumptions, since I never spoke to any of the rabbonim that I served about this issue. I would also add that growing up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan during the 60s and early 1970s, there are many food establishments, including butchers, who sold their products to the public and had no kosher certification attached to the establishment. In this regard, I would note that I delivered meat for one of the local butchers who was Shomer Torah and Mitzvos in 1964 and 65. He had no kosher certification, nor a mashgiach supervising the kosher of his establishment. Amongst his customers to whom I delivered meat were numerous Gedolei Yisrael, who must also have relied on his trustworthiness as a muchzak b'kashrus. So I thank Eli Feig for adding another piece to the puzzle, the history from the 60s and 70s, in totally in line with what I pointed out, what others pointed out, not just in America, the situation in Europe as well. I said that if you want to have a takana in the modern Orthodox world, I think it's a good takana to have. But to invent this idea that it's forbidden, that you need hashgacha or it's no good, that just is not historically correct. Now, I want to pick up with Eli Feig says that Ramosha was following the less stringent view allied by the poskim. There's no less stringent view. Ramosha's following the view, the only view that there is. What does the Beis Hillel say? The Beis Hillel says that the Vat Arba Aretzos, they had a decree that you couldn't buy food from someone unless he had in his hand a ketav, something written, Katuv v'chatum is av beis din shenaseh b'hechsher, something that the av beis din testifies that it's kosher. Even if he's a muchzak b'chashrus, they said as a lo pug, that is, you go to a fair and you see a guy who looks religious, you could eat at such a person's house, but here he's selling food. The halacha is that if you would assume, you speak to him, you assume he's religious, you could buy the food. But they said that because there could be problems, they're going to say that you need a letter testifying to its kashrus, even if the person is a muchzak b'kashrus because of lo plug. That is, l'fi halacha, you don't even really need to know him. You just see he's a religious Jew. Just like you go to shul and someone invites you, you could eat at your house, you see a guy who's religious, you could buy from him. So they changed it, and they said that even if he's a muchzak b'kashrus, you still need to have a sorry, take that back. If he's a muchzak b'kashrus, even if he's a muchzak b'kashrus, you need to have a letter because of lo plug, because of someone you don't know. But it says that if this person is a muchzak b'kashrus lost the letter, you could still buy it. Now, what is the Beis Hillel referring to? He's referring to food that's made by people in their house and sell. He's not referring to someone, a mashgiach, who comes in and checks the house. That's what the rabbis were doing. They weren't going into people's houses and looking. They were testifying that this person is a muchzak b'kashrus, you can eat his food. Incidentally, Rav Chaim Kanievsky I mentioned says that we don't hold by the Beis Hillel. That, if the kollel wife wants to sell cake Thursday night to the locals, you can buy from her. She doesn't need a letter from a rav saying she's a muchzak b'kashrus. You know she is. But that's what we're talking about. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who ate at these hotels, was not being makel. He wasn't relying on lenient opinions that disagree with the Beis Hillel. He was following exactly the Beis Hillel. He knew these people. He knew their muchzak b'kashrus. He doesn't need a letter from another Av Beis Din, another rabbi telling him that Moshe Neumann is the muchzak b'kashrus you could eat there. He knew them personally. That's the situation. And that's, I mean, you go today, you go to Gerba. And, you have a number of food establishments. Some of you listening went with me in the summer. There's no hashgacha, but the rabbi says that all these people are muchzak b'kashrus. If he didn't think they're muchzak b'kashrus, I'll tell you, you can't eat there. But it's not an official hashgacha. It's simply a declaration that these people are muchzak b'kashrus. You can eat there, and that's exactly what Eli Feig is talking about. And but there's no Rav Moshe being make or anything like that. Rav Moshe was following the halacha, the only halacha. Unless you want to have a takana, then you do things differently. Okay, let us pick up where we are. We're actually going to go quicker because a lot of the things in coming up in the next 100 pages we've already seen. So we're going to, we're about another 200 pages left in the book, but we should do about 100 today. I wanted to, I thought that the Rav in, his letters that we're going to deal with dealt with discussed halal on Yom Ha'atzmaut. He actually doesn't, so I'm not gonna. I decided I'm not really going to get into it. Just point out to you a couple of things that you can see in the book here, the Rav thinking aloud. A whole discussion of this goes. The whole section two is called halal on Yom Ha'atzmaut, and it deals with. It's a tape of the Rav, his reaction when he saw the what went on in YU, and anyone can read it. I don't need to get into details. I just want to call your attention to a couple of things that people might find of interest. One is that the Rav said that he has no problem with halal. at the end of davening, now without a bracha. And he says that if the students at YU, he came in and he saw that they were reading, they took it a Sefer Torah and they did a Haftar, he walked out, he was very annoyed. But if all they did was Hallel, he says he has no problem with that. But after davening, and he explains why it should be after davening. Then he says he gets into the business of a Haftarah, which apparently is in, which is in the liturgy of Yom HaTzmaut for Bnei Akiva. I guess it's Bnei Akiva or the Rabbanut or Mizrahi, one of them. And he thinks this is Amaratzus. He says there's no notion of a Haftarah. He says we don't read a Haftarah on Chol HaMoed. You don't read a Haftarah when you when you go to work. And therefore, the idea that you read a Haftarah and Chol HaMoed, he sees this as just crazy. And then on, but on page 211, we see that he doesn't oppose music on Yom HaTzmaut. He says that he says he only objects to the Haftarah and the bracha of Hallel and doing things in tefillah. But if you want to have music in Yom HaTzmaut, he does not see that as a problem, even though it's during Sfira. And he doesn't. They ask him, "What about extended Pesukei Zimra?" Because in the liturgy for Yom HaTzmaut, they read Pesukei Zimra like it's Shabbos or Yom Tov. And he says, "We do this on Hoshana Rabbah," and it was, you know, that's not halacha. That's a minhag. It was accepted. So he says, "I will even tolerate that." So the Rav did not have an issue with. You have to be careful. The Rav isn't an agudist here, where he and he's not even one of the. It's a liberal agudas. So the old joke was in Yom HaTzmaut, they do like Ben Gurion, no Hallel and no Tachnun. I mean, the Rav wasn't. The Rav, by the way, has no problem saying Tachnun. He says you could say Tachnun. He's not. He says that. I'll tell you what he says about Tachnun, because he's not crazy about. I mean, he's not going to insist on it, but he says Tachnun, I'll forego. I don't see why Tachnun is made a patriotic duty. He says, I don't see why you should say Tachnun. He says, you could say it. They're not mutually exclusive, Hallel and Tachnun, but he doesn't see a big deal. You want to give up Tachnun? Give up Tachnun. And he's okay with adding in other things to the davening in Pesukei Zimra. But other areas, he sees it as more halachically difficult because it breaks with the tradition in a more halachically problematic way. But he has no problem after davening saying Hallel. Look, an agudist would never allow you to have a whole suda with live music on Yom HaTzmaut. And the Rav doesn't have an issue with it, and he doesn't have an issue with leaving out Tachanun. So we have to put the Rav in his proper place. Where are we now? In the section of the book, pages 143 on, they have a translation of. The Rav did 10-part series of interviews in the paper, the Tug Morgan, which then became the Morgan Journal. No, the Tug Morgan, it was the Tug and the Morgan Journal, and they joined together. And they translate, as far as I know, they haven't translated all of them. You can see in the new book, the Fishman book, which has all the Yiddish letters, the Yiddish drashos of the Rav, they include this. So here we have translated. One of the second of the 10-part series, and it's very important. It was reprinted in the Bunim book also, the book about Irving Bunim, because the Rav sets forth an important principle. He was asked how Orthodox Jews should relate, should cooperate with the non-Orthodox facing the outside world. Now, we know how they did this in Germany. In fact, next semester, we only have maybe four or five more, maybe four classes, maybe five, dealing with the Rav, and then we're going to get to Rav Zalman Bayer Bamberger, and a big issue there, which we'll spend a few classes on, is his dispute with Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch about religious separatism. I'll even bring it up to the contemporary period. And in Germany, you had religious separatists. In Hungary, you had religious separatists. So that is, you had separate kehillahs. You had the Orthodox. They pay taxes to their kehillah, recognized by the government separately. That was the situation in Hungary and in Germany. That was not the case in Lithuania. And the Nitziv famously rejects this. He responded to, in Galicia, there was a group called the Machzikei Hadas. They wanted to bring the Hungarian approach into Galicia. Separatism. Complete communal separatism. And the Nitziv writes that such an approach is a dagger in our hearts. He says, when we deal with one another, Jews, we fight, of course. But when we deal with the outside world, we go with one group together, one wall. We face them as the Jewish people. We don't come separately, Orthodox, non-Orthodox. And that was the approach in Lithuania and every Lithuanian town in Poland also. You know, even in Brisk, you had everyone voted, and you had in Warsaw, you had the Bundists and you had the Orthodox, and they didn't want it any other way. They thought that there's value of being together, even with all the problems of being with the non-Orthodox. We still are together. It's like the state of Israel today. Yes, you have a small separatist group, the Yad HaRedit, but the Aguda in the state of Israel from the beginning believed in being in the Knesset. They were in the Knesset in Poland. They could be in Knesset in Israel. And when you have a situation like we have today, all the fighting is finished, Jew versus Jew, and you're unified and you come together. And that's the approach that the Rav channels here. He didn't make it up. It's, as I said, it's the traditional Lithuanian approach. I do have to say that the Aguda today is mostly in that camp, but not 100%. I mean, they follow this as a when it comes to the leadership, that is to meet with the president. They'll all go together, the Aguda person and the non-religious Jew, they'll all go together. But the Aguda, when it comes to the masses, they find it very difficult to have a more tolerant policy. And if you recall, I think it's in 2001 or 2000, 2002 when bombs were going off in Israel every day and there was that huge rally in Washington, D.C. The Aguda, there was inner dispute about among the Aguda, should we attend or not? And in the end, they said not to attend because they just can't allow their masses to go to an event where they don't control it. And there was this when the certain, what you would say, Haredim joined the World Zionist, or it was the World Zionist organization, there was a big split among them. So that's their issue. But the Rav follows the traditional Lithuanian approach. He says, when we're faced with a problem for Jews and Jewish interests towards the world without, regarding the defense of Jewish rights, all movements must be united. He says that you could be an old-fashioned Jew, he says, old-fashioned in quotes, from Mea Shearim, or a Jew like Mendes France from France, who's very assimilated. But, you know, we have this idea of unity. And he says in the quote, in the crematoria, the ashes of the Hasidim and pious Jews are put together with the ashes of the radicals and the atheists. And we all must fight the enemy who does not differentiate between those who believe in God and those who reject him. I think today, even among the separatists, for the most part, we don't have hard, strong separatism like we used to have. I mean, the German Orthodox in 33, 34 believed even with Hitler to have a separate, if you read my book on Rav Yaakov Weinberg, you know this. They believe that when dealing with the Nazis, they should be a separate organization, not with the larger community. They later changed that position. By the late 30s, they understood that Nazi Germany was unlike anything else they had seen. But for the most part, leaving aside Naturae Carta, things like that, Satmar, standard right-wing Orthodox Judaism agrees that at times like today, we all have to be together. However, what about internally? And that's more problematic because then, you know, how can we have unity with the Rav calls spiritual religion, you know, spiritual religion, spiritual ideological collectivism? How can we have that with the non-Orthodox? He says, in his opinion, Orthodoxy cannot and should not unite with those groups that deny the basis of our Weltanschauung. He says, how can we, that is rabbis who spent the best years of our life studying Torah, Torah Shebichtav, Baal Peh, for whom the Rambam and the Ramban, the Gaon of Vilna, Chaim Brisker, you know, they're what our spiritual world is based on. How can we join together with people who reject this? He says, he goes further. He says, spiritual leaders for whom all this is worthless. That's maybe going a little too far, because at least some of these spiritual leaders see value in that, at least in the conservatives. He says, a rabbinical organization is not a professional fraternity. We can't be Orthodox rabbis together with non-Orthodox rabbis. He says, that's never before happened in history. He says, the difference between the Orthodox and Reform is greater than that which separated the Pharisees from the Sadducees. Has Jewish history ever recorded an instance of a joint community council or a joint rabbinical council consisting of Karaites and Torah-true Jews? I don't think about Karaites, but you could point out that in the days of the Beis HaMikdash, didn't you have Sadducees who were involved in the Beis HaMikdash and involved in religious life together with the Pharisees, together with the rabbis? I don't know, maybe not the sort that the Rav is speaking about, but he says, absolutely, we can't be together. Incidentally, when it comes to the Karaites, even although we don't have rabbis together like this, we know that they were much closer than people used to think. We have ketubas from the Geniza and elsewhere that show interfaith marriage, if that's the term we should use, between Karaites and Rabbanites. Something which, for a long time, was thought to be unimaginable, but there was crossover between the two communities. And as part of the ketubah, it had to. It mentioned which one community they came from, and as I recall, I think we have ketubas that allow the women, she's allowed to follow the Karaite practice about Shabbos, things like that. He explains why we can't be together with the non-Orthodox. He says, first of all, we're Lamdani. You have to be aware, we do Torah study. They're not Lamdani. And second of all, even if they were learned Torah, it's not the Torah we learn. Because they don't accept everything that we accept. They don't accept Torah Shebichtav in its entirety the way we do. They don't accept Torah Shebaal Peh at all times and all places. And he says, and if they're going to show me in the conservative movement, he specifically mentioned the conservative movement, that there are some rabbis who, no, if you're going to say the conservative movement really will recognize this and is willing to declare publicly that we accept Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh, then the Rav says, if this miracle happens, I have a problem then. How can you accept this at the same time permit riding to the synagogue on the Sabbath and permit marriages between divorcees and kohanim? It's one or the other. If you accept Torah in its entirety, you never could permit that. And therefore, you can't even get to the beginning, to the first base here with them, because they don't accept certain fundamentals. So rabbinically, we can't be together with them. We can't have a rabbinic organization with them. However, for community, he said he refers to it councils of rabbis, Jewish education. He also says synagogues. So that's interesting because we'll see what it says about the synagogue council. He says synagogues, Jewish education councils of rabbis, because though their unity has to be based on spiritual ideas, then you can't be together. But when it has to do with the defense of the Jews, our interest in the larger world, the Rav doesn't have a problem joining together. He thinks that's okay. And that's something that the Aguda, although their leadership today will join with the non-Orthodox when they think it's vital, they will not join in any sort of organizational way, to my knowledge. So the Rav's a little more liberal. The Rav you see in this letter, he sees the conservative movement is more problematic. He says the Reform movement does the same as Saul of Tarsus, same as Paul. Basically, they're like Christians without the belief in Jesus. They don't believe in the law. That's what Paul said. You don't need the law for salvation. So the Reform said the same thing. So that they're not even an issue. The issue is the conservative movement. And the Rav, this is in the 50s, when take us back to the class on Saul Lieberman, you see that there was a real battle here, and the Orthodox at that time were losing, and there was a temptation among many to say, well, the conservative really are halachic. They just cut corners in a few ways, but that's, we can make our peace with that. And the Rav, as we know, was very strong. So the real issue is the conservative, because he says when the conservative movement speaks of halacha, we can't perceive what the halacha is. Which halacha is it? Is it Rabbi Akiva? Is it Rabbi Yosef Karo? Or is it the new halacha that's invented by the rabbinical assembly? Which basically, if it's convenient, you follow. If not, you don't. And he ends by saying that in Israel, the Mapai, Ben Gurion's group, totally irreligious, but they understood that when it comes to Jewish law, you have to leave it in the hands of the Orthodox. And he hopes that the conservative movement will recognize that, look what he calls them, the atheistic Mapai, that they should follow the footsteps of the atheistic Mapai. Okay, so that's his long interview in the Morgen Journal. Then we see, beginning on pages 151, he deals with the issue of a number of letters here, three letters or two letters. There are two organizations. You had boards, New York Board of Rabbis, let's take New York, and you had other cities, the same thing. That is an organization where you had rabbis of all the denominations came together, and they would have meetings, and they would put out the statements, and it was for the benefit of the Jewish people. It was thought important for all the different rabbis to get together, and they had an agreement they wouldn't talk about religious matters. But the Rav still said that, how can you put rabbis together? Because the whole idea of a rabbi is about spiritual camaraderie. There was also an organization called the Synagogue Council of America that the OU was a part of, and that as the non-Orthodox organizations were a part of. And that was really, although the Rav also says that synagogues can't be with the non-Orthodox, the point of the Synagogue Council of America was really to connect all Jews in America. Jews belong to synagogues. Where else are they going to be part of? You don't need B'nai B'rith. I mean, Jews are part members of synagogues, at least in those days. So, like today, the Synagogue Council of America, if they would have all the Orthodox conservative reform, they would be very much in the forefront of events to commemorate and to bring unity, what's going on, reaching out to Congress, issues of anti-Semitism, all these sorts of issues. Well, can the Orthodox be part of it? Well, the OU was a part of it, and I have to tell you that Orthodox rabbis were also a part of the New York Board of Rabbis and other Board of Rabbis. There was a rabbi even in Camden, New Jersey. Believe it or not, Camden, New Jersey had an Orthodox community. For some time during the 1990s, Camden, New Jersey was the murder capital of America.
You have to
I don't
throw
think
out
it is
my
anymore.
water.
It's probably Seattle or
Anything close
Portland
to
or somewhere like that. But it was indeed the murder capital. And there was a great rabbi there. His name was Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Rief. You can already see from his name, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda, who he's an anacle, a grandson of, a great grandson. I believe he was that the Netziv. And he was a member of a joint rabbinic council. The rabbi in Scranton, where I work, Rabbi Gutterman, an old Sobotka Talmud, big Lamdin, he used to come in and do help with the smicha exams, Yeshiva Elchanan. He also was involved with the non-Orthodox rabbis. I was told by the current rabbi of Scranton, well, in those days, the Orthodox were weak. That's why he had to. And maybe he's right. That could be the case. I don't know. Well, or it could be that they didn't really see it as an issue. If the rabbis kept away from dealing with religious issues. Now, I mean, as I said, the Rav says that when it comes to councils of rabbis, it's my opinion that Orthodoxy cannot and should not unite with such groups that deny the fundamentals of our Weltanschauung. But in the 1950s, the Orthodox rabbis, many of them, the graduates of Yeshivas Elchanan, and especially in Hebrew Theological College, were members of these organizations. And then an earthquake hit because the leading rabbani in the right wing world, and not just in the right wing world, because this letter was also signed by two figures of Yeshivas Elchanan, Rav David Lifshitz, the Svalker Rav, and Menachem Yosef Zaks, who's what they call the Bochein at Yeshivas Elchanan, the son-in-law of the Rav. And here you have the letter, as it appeared from Adar of 1956, that they were asked, really it's Rav Aaron Cutler who was the person who pushed this, but they were asked whether rabbis can be members of the New York Board of Rabbis, and can synagogue groups be in organizations like the Synagogue Council of America. And they come out with a ruling here, ex cathedra, almost like Das Torah, without any sources or anything explaining, because there were other rabbis who were more members of this group. And you had in Germany already had groups like this that the Orthodox rabbis were part of, many of them. But it's signed by so many of the Gedolei Yisrael here. And I don't want to get into the letters too much because I look at this very carefully when we do get into Rav Zalman Ber Bamberger, because the dispute that existed in Germany between Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch and Rav Zalman Ber Bamberger is this very dispute. Can you be involved with the non-Orthodox for matters of communal concern? And when we return to this in a few weeks, I'll point out to you that in addition to Rav Soloveitchik's name not being here, obviously, another great rabbi's name is missing. Maybe the most distinguished of all the old-fashioned East European rabbanim. Revelia's or Silver. Why didn't Revelia's or Silver sign this? So we'll get to that. We'll also talk about this is really the beginning of the movement. Look, every one of these Rabbanim here is a Rosh Yeshiva. Whatever happened to pulpit rabbis? It used to be that communal Rabbanim determined policy. And yet every one of the Rabbanim here are Rosh Yeshiva. Here we see the beginning of the movement, the center of power in American Orthodoxy from the communal Rabbanim to the Rosh Yeshiva. So we'll return to all this, but this hit like an earthquake because here you have the Gedol Yisrael in America declaring that it's usher to be New York Board of Rabbis, Synagogue Council of America. Well, understandably, the Rav is therefore asked, well, what do you think? Because you're our Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, and you didn't sign this. And Moshe Feinstein is reported to have said that normally we have a principle, shtika koda adamya, that if you're silent, that shows you agree, your acquiescence. And since the Rav didn't sign it, then so he agrees. But Ramosha says, not in this case, I don't think. And he's right, because when the Rav was asked this, now, we saw already the interview. The interview that the Rav gave is 54, where he's saying he's opposed to it. But there's a difference between being opposed to something and saying it's usur. The Rav says that I don't see how Orthodoxy can unite with this. But is that the same thing as saying it's usser? Absolutely usser? The Rav was a stickler for this, say, distinguishing between what he thought his opinion was and what is usser. He would only come out with a statement if he thought it was absolutely usser. If he thought it was a terrible thing to do, he would say it's a terrible thing to do, but he wouldn't use the word usser. In fact, they say that that's why the Rav never signed the letter, if you recall, in the 80s. It was towards the end of his time as really being active, but the women's prayer groups, was it women's prayer groups or women getting Aliyah? I guess it was Torah. I forget which one it was. One of these things that the other Rabbanim all said it was usser. The Rav was very opposed to it, but he didn't like using the word isser for something that's not pure halacha. This is the Rav's tradition. The Rav in Halacha Gan mentions that his grandfather got in a big dispute with the other Rabbanim because the other Rabbanim came out with a gezeira that if you don't circumcise your son, you cannot be buried in a Jewish cemetery. And Rav Chaim said, well, what does one have to do with the other? Not circumcising your son is a great sin, but what does that have to do with where do we see that you can say you can't bury someone in a cemetery? So he's a mumar for this. It doesn't mean you can't bury him in a cemetery. And the Rav says that for the matter of public policy, the other rabbis were correct. This is a gezeirah to force people to circumcise their sons. But Reb Chaim, for him, it had to be pure halacha. And so the Rav is asked in 1956, very shortly after, it says 5 days. Now, 5 days before the scheduled meeting of the Halacha Commission, where they're going to take this up, the declaration which I showed you appeared. The Rav replies that, signed also by Belkin, that we can't give an answer right now. He says, at the present time, under the present circumstances, it's humanly impossible to discuss impartially this matter. Okay, after all the Rabbanim came out with this ruling, they didn't think they could give an answer. And the following year, 1957, the Rav says the same thing, and Belkin, that we still don't think we can give an answer. And they don't give an answer. But the fact that they didn't give an answer was the answer, because they never came out against it, although they never came out with a, which is what some people wanted. They never, he says, it says, a year has passed since you asked us last. And the RCA is coming for its annual convention, and they want instructions from the Halacha Commission regarding the RCA's relationship to the Synagogue Council. It's not just the OU, it's the RCA. RCA and OU were also very close in those days. In the end, they don't come out with, I think what the Rav wanted to do was come out with a long letter explaining the different positions. In the end, as far as I know, he never comes out with any letter, any explanation, but he never comes out opposing it either. So everything, it's Shev al-Tasa, everything remained. And according to people who knew the Rav, at least what I've been told, and we have someone who listens to us whose father was very close to the Rav, I don't know, one of the closest, so I hope he will enlighten me in his email. He always sends me emails commenting on the classes. My sense, and this has been affirmed by people who knew the Rav, was that the Rav actually thought that the Synagogue Council of America was a positive thing, and the OU should be involved with it. As to the RCA involved with it, I don't know. Remember, the RCA is a rabbinic organization. And I don't know if he had any feelings about that. The OU, he thought it was important to be in the Synagogue Council of America. No, new. That seems to contradict what he says earlier. I don't have any, what he says in the Morgenzer now. I don't have an answer. I can just tell you that the Rav never told anyone that the OU should pull out of the Synagogue Council of America, and that's a problem. Now, as for the New York Board of Rabbis, we saw the Rav was very clear that there's no place for an Orthodox rabbi sitting with other rabbis. I've also been told by people that that's what the Rav's position was, that he would tell people that he didn't see this as having any value, but he never said it's usher. And a number of the Rav's Talmidim, like Rabbi Lookstein, for instance, very, very close student to the Rav. He was very involved with the New York Board of Rabbis, one of the leaders in the New York Board of Rabbis. He never would have remained in New York on the New York Board of Rabbis if the Rav said it's usher. The Rav's opinion was, as look, you can ask Rabbi Lookstein, maybe he had a conversation, and the Rav's attitude towards him was, if you feel it's valuable, you could do it. What I've heard from people is that the Rav's attitude was negative. He's saying, I don't see the point of it. But he never said it's forbidden, and therefore he left it open for his students, if they thought it was necessary or important, that they could do it. I mean, perhaps you can make distinctions in a small town versus a big city. I don't know. But synagogue council, the Rav thought it was important for the OU to be part of it. New York Board of Rabbis, he didn't see the value, but he doesn't declare it's usher. It's the same thing was in Germany. In Germany, you had the mainstream Orthodox rabbis, that is not the Hirschians, but the non-separatist rabbis. Most of them were members of an organization. It was called the Allgemeine Rabbinerverband. Basically, it was an organization of rabbis, Orthodox and non-Orthodox, and Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg never said it was forbidden, and only the separatist rabbi said it was forbidden. So, if anyone has any or listens later, any other information on this, please email it to me, and I'll share it with the class. But it is a fact that the Rav never said it was forbidden, and this was a sore point, a sticking point, because the rabbani who signed the letter, they couldn't really enforce their ruling because most of the members, not the only ones, but most of the members of these organizations were students of Soloveitchik. And in fact, that's why Rav Reuven Grozovsky is said not to have signed the letter. Even though he's very much on the right wing, he said that, look, these rabbis are not our students. They're students of Yosef Soloveitchik, the Rav. And therefore, it should be for the Rav to tell them not to do it. And if the Rav doesn't say it's a problem, then why are we mixing in and telling them what to do? And it is a fact that Rav never said that it's forbidden to be a member of the New York Board of Rabbis. Now, the New York Board of Rabbis, I guess it still exists. I think the Synagogue Council of America closed down, but the New York Board of Rabbis, are the Orthodox rabbis? I guess so. There are still, I've seen the names. There's still some YU rabbis on it. It seems it's more the YCT type of rabbi. But in small towns, I have friends in small towns. There's small towns, maybe three rabbis. You have the Orthodox, Conservative, Reform. They don't have a rabbinic organization, but they function together as one. If you're in a smaller town, it's very hard to be a separatist in that respect. And okay, well, we have some more time. Let's go on. I'm going to skip the next one. The next letter deals with the propriety of a shul owning a company open on Shabbos. A shul had an opportunity to own a company, make money, but it was open on Shabbos, and the rabbi of the shul refused to sanction it. In fact, it's a problem because the synagogue board didn't. Usually, the rabbi is the final say, but sometimes the synagogue board hears what the rabbi says and says, "Rabbi, we hear what you say, but we're not going to listen." And this rabbi, Rabbi Moshe Gorelick, from Fall River, Massachusetts, he had to resign because of that. I mean, people like to think that in the olden days, the rabbis got more kavod than today. Throughout Jewish history, we have plenty of cases where rabbis, even Gedolei Yisrael, where the machers of the community refuse to go along with them. In Chicago, we have people from Chicago. When the Mizrahis want to sell their building, sell it to this Buddhist group or something, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik came out strongly against it, said it's absolutely usur. But the machers said, okay, we hear you, Rav Aaron, but we're not going to listen. So we have examples of that. So we're going to skip that letter. And then beginning on page 163 and on, it's all about religious Zionism. And who is a Jew? We've done all these things, or most of them. We did them when we discussed who is a Jew. We did in great detail, Brother Daniel, religious Zionism, Yom HaTzmaut. He has a letter here about Yom HaTzmaut. He's not really getting into halachic sources. He's just speaking about the value of the state. And we spoke about that, so we don't need to. Then in pages 173 and on, it's all about the chief rabbinate. We did that. We did all these. We did classes dealing with his view of the chief rabbinate, why he refused to accept the position, the problems of the chief rabbinate. That's a government institution. His identification with Mizrahi, for all his criticism of Mizrahi, we saw that to the end he remains a Mizrahi member, and he sees them as the most important religious party in Israel for what they're doing, religion and state. Pretty much, we've done all these things. I just want to call your attention to one thing on page 217, and. Because this is fascinating. It's included in a letter that deals with religion and state. But he includes something else in here, which even before HealthGod published this, I knew this because Rabbi Walter Wurzberger, he has an article in Tradition called The Rav Posek of Postmodern Orthodoxy, something like that, and he records this, and I had heard it from others as well, but here in the Rav's own hand. And I have to say, I don't understand what the Rav says here. It doesn't make sense to me. And I don't understand it, but I'll tell you what it is. The Rav says, I'll read it to you. He's writing to Yitzhak Goldschlag, if you recall, a leading religious Zionist figure in Israel, Mizrahi figure. I will reveal a secret to you, my friend. In my entire life, I have never signed a Heter Meir Rabbanim, even in cases where the Halachic foundation for it is sound. A woman who's married to a man, and the man, for instance, disappears or something, won't give a get, that's a problem. She's an aguna. A man, of course, has to give his wife a get. But if the wife refuses to accept her, the wife disappears, there's a solution. And the solution is called a heter meir rabbanim. You get, this is an old, going back, Rishonim, because a man can't marry more than one wife, after Rabbeinu Gershom, but technically he can, according to Torah and rabbinic law. So therefore, you get 100 rabbis to sign this document, and he's allowed to remarry. So even if his wife has disappeared, he can remarry without a get. Now, this unfortunately sometimes is used in a corrupt fashion. There's a rabbi in Muncie who, if someone doesn't want to give his wife a get and hold her hostage, you can go to this rabbi in Muncie, and he'll give you a heter meir rabbanim. That's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about when the man doesn't want to give his wife a get. We're talking about when he can't give his wife a get. So there's a solution called the heter meir rabbanim. And the way they would do this in the olden days, they'd send the letter out to the different rabbis. Today, they'll come to a rabbinic convention, and there's a lot of rabbis there, and they'll get them to sign it. And like, let's say the woman it was in a terrible accident, or and she can't. She's a vegetable, or the woman has disappeared, or the woman became irreligious, totally irreligious, and abandoned her husband and wants nothing to do with this. And so that there's all sorts of solutions. But the Rav says he never signed a heter meir rabbanim, and he says that he says an American Jew will understand that halacha demands that when there's no halacha divorce, it's impossible to marry or be married. He says one fate is shared by husband and wife. He says we can't tell Jews in America that there's a different standard here, that the woman can't get remarried. She's an aguna, but the man, even though he's in the same situation as a woman, we have a solution. We can save the man and redeem him, as it were, from his difficult state. The Rav says this will cast halacha into disrepute. It's almost like he says that Takana today, we can't allow this because such a ruling, he says, in our day is in the category of halacha vein morin kein. That is, it's on the books, but we can't do it. He says there are many rabbis who do sign heter merabanim in exceptional cases. However, to use such leniencies with arbitrariness is against the tradition of Torah scholars who are diligent to protect the interests of Jewish women. The way I read this is he's saying that I will never sign it. He's not saying that you can't do it, because he does say that there are rabbis who, in exceptional circumstances, will sign it, but we can't use such leniencies arbitrarily. So he's not saying not to ever use it. He's not saying if he's at the RCA convention and passing out a Heter Merabanim, throw it away. It doesn't apply anymore. What he's saying is that he'll never sign it. And that generally it's halacha ve'en morin kein, but in exceptional circumstances, he seems to be saying that you can. But then why wouldn't he sign it? If it's valid, why not sign it? And why is this such a problem? Are we so, if I could ask the Rav, I'd ask him, I understand with this idea that you want the halacha to present in a certain way, so not to bring it into disrepute, but at the end of the day, who's going to suffer? We have a man here who's not going to be able to get remarried. I have to say, I don't understand this. And if anyone can enlighten me as to why the Rav is putting halacha writ large, to have American Jewry accept halacha, not see it as discriminatory to women, is having heter merabanim in exceptional cases going to do that? So, and if not, and he seems to acknowledge that in exceptional cases, it would be okay. Why, Rav Soloveitchik, won't you sign it? He says even when the Halachic foundation for it is sound. I don't understand this at all. Okay, we'll stop here. The where we're going to pick up next class, we're moving all the way ahead to pages 228. So we did about 80 pages today, and it's going to be a fascinating letter because a young woman who doesn't know the Rav, teacher in Israel, writes a letter to the Rav. In fact, she's 29 years old, I see, when she writes it, asking the Rav, you're such a Zionist. We all study your work, Kol Dodito Feik. How is it that you are not moving to the land of Israel? What chutzpah for her to ask that? No, a student of the Rav would never have the chutzpah to ask the question. Hey, Rebbe, you talk a good game, religious Zionist, and yet why won't you go to Israel? But here you have someone in Israel, a teacher in Israel. She had the chutzpah, and wait till you see what the Rav says to her. He's moded to her that you're right. But it's an amazing, and we would not have this letter unless this teacher, Zichrono Livracha, she died unfortunately young. We would not have this letter unless this teacher, name is Miriam Shilo, had the chutzpah to write to the Rav and really put his feet to the fire. On the one hand, you're a big Zionist, Rebbe, but on the other hand, why aren't you coming to the land of Israel? So we have from the Rav's own pen an explanation. You might not buy it completely. I don't buy it entirely, because even when the Rav What the Rav speaks about wasn't there, the Rav still had this hesitation, not just to move there, even to visit, but it's the only example I know of where, from the Rav's own pen, he at least tries to explain how is it that a Zionist like him refuses to go to the state of Israel. So we'll pick up next class with that, and then we're getting on. We're not moving. Four or five more classes, I think. Okay, let me see the questions here, the comments here. We're a smaller group today. Janine says Torah learning is an essential way to keep grounded. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Thomas said did the Rav bar non-Jews from his classes. No non-Jews were in the shiur at YU. Saturday night? I don't know. Look, it was. He gave a class at Maimonides. I don't know if any non-Jews came, and if a non-Jew came, I don't know if he said that they couldn't come, they'd have to leave. I really don't know. I have no idea. It wasn't very common. The idea of Morton Smith going to Rav Savitsky shiur. Now, Rav Savitsky, to allow him to stay in the shiur, had to consider the issue of teaching a non-Jew Torah. Now, Morton Smith is not just any non-Jew. He's a non-Jew who knows lots and lots of Torah. He's like Christine Hayes. but that's a Talmud, I should say. But this is an issue that's come up in Israel recently a good deal because you have they call them Filipinos. They Americans who are elderly or people from England, so you hire people from the Philippines to help take care of them, and they take them to shiurim. They take him everywhere. They go to shiur, and the Filipino, he knows English. He sits and listens to the shiur. So the rabbi is giving a shiur on Gemara. Can you give a shiur with a non-Jew there? And all the rabbanim have said, absolutely, you can, because you're not giving the shiur to the non-Jew. You're giving it to the Jews. The non-Jew just listens. Rabbi Teitz dealt with this issue when he started on the radio. First, he did Gemara on the Daf HaShavua in Yiddish. Okay, so you say non-Jews don't know Yiddish, but then Rav Elazar Meir started doing it in English. And look, we don't have to refrain from teaching Torah. It would be like saying we can't put anything on YouTube because a non-Jew could listen to it. And then you have Rabbi Chaya of Weinberg. He says it depends why the non-Jews learning Torah. If they're learning Torah for intellectual reasons, that's okay. If they're learning it to find out our secrets to then destroy us, that's a problem. There's all sorts of ways of understanding it. So I don't know what the Rav would have responded. I can tell you that his son-in-law, Professor Twersky, taught Torah at Harvard University, and any non-Jew who wanted to could attend his class. I was Professor Rabbi Dr. Twersky's TA at Harvard, and where the title of the class was Extremism and Moderation. If you read the course description, it was Aristotle, Plato, Kant, Maimonides. It was like two classes of Aristotle and Kant, and the whole rest of the semester was Maimonides. And the class was mostly non-Jews. So you're asking how did Professor Twersky? Well, I assume he discussed this matter many years ago with his father-in-law, and the Rabbi Soloveitchik held, like, just like the Sridi Yesh, that in academic settings there's no issue of teaching Torah. Rabbi Gifter, one of Rabbi Weinberg's letters about teaching Torah to non-Jews, is I have the original response in the Sridi Yesh. It doesn't say who it's to. It just says Gadol or Gaon Echad. It was written to Rabbi Gifter. Mordechai Gifter was invited to speak about Talmudic issues at Case Western University, and he didn't know if he was allowed to. And he wrote to Rabbi Weinberg, and Rabbi Weinberg wrote him the tshuva. And upon receiving this tshuva, Rabbi Gifter gave the class, not alone a shiur, but the lecture at Case Western University. So I don't know about the Rav. Mark says Rabbi Adler, Yosef Adler, big student of the Rav, told us that the Rav was adamant about eating a Sukkah Shemini Atzeres, even if his father's Minhag not to. Yeah, because he's a Shulchan Aruch Jew. And that's what actually the rabbi of my town also
The
said.
context was the Rav was very big on. Somebody asked him a question. Frequently the response was, "What does your father do?" But there were three exceptions: Sukkah and Shmini Atzeres, the Kesher and the Shul Rosh, and for the life of me, I can't remember the third.
The Kesher, what, he thought it should be square or Dalet?
No, the Yud, not a square, not. But that was one of the things where he said, even if that
Well,
was
because he
Father's Minhag,
thought this
he's
was a
correct.
Minhag Tos. He thought this wasn't just a Hasidic practice. And yet they have sources and they defend it. Another thing the Rav was very strong about when he came to Boston, he found that on Shabbos, Yom Tov that came on Shabbos, they didn't daven. And the Rav fought this. He thought it was Amoratzos, and he lost that battle. They did not daven on
Didn't look at all.
Shabbos. No, when Yom Tov came out on Shabbos, they didn't daven. And years later, I heard this from Mark Heffet, he said that before he took on this practice, he should have become more established and then taken it on because it created. Now, the Rav regarded this as Amoratzos, and yet I found that there are Achronim who talk about this. Rabbi Chiya of Weinberg mentions this as a Minhag Gemilta not to do it. So it's, I've never seen it in America, but this is definitely a Minhag Gemilta, because Rabbi Chiya of Weinberg mentions this, and I found a justification for it. I found a sefer, I went looking for it. And so, look, I know that if I show this to the Rav, the fact that I found a sefer where the sefer justifies not duchening on Shabbos, Yom Tov, the Rav would say, so what? You found a sefer. It's still Amoratzos. I mean, the Rav wouldn't be impressed just that I found a sefer, but I mean, it's
It
not,
sounds like
it isn't just a Amoratzim saying it. Yeah, that was
I
in
got
Boston,
confused.
not duchening
It
on
sounds like I got
Shabbos.
confused about limiting that Tzavos Shalom.
Say again?
It sounds like whoever started that meter got confused about not doing Atzofus Cholom. You don't know why
I
eyes on
don't know.
Shabbos.
The Rav thought it was a min hatos. The Rav thought it's absolutely a mistake. Next class, I'll bring the Sri Yesh if I can find it, because he mentions it also. This might be a practice that's full, completely disappeared. There are certain minhagim that completely disappeared, but this was something not duchening on Shabbos. Maybe some of the old timers remember that. Gershon says, could we say that not saying something is forbidden, usur, and just being opposed to it, that the latter approach implies to act a certain way as putter, but usur? No. Something, the Rav could think something is completely wrong. The Rav thought that Yitz Grim, that's going to speak theology to the Christians, was wrong. It makes no sense. And yet when Yitz Greenberg spoke to him, he said, that's my opinion. If you don't want to accept it, fine. You can do it. I wish you the best. But I think it's a big mistake. Lots of things could be wrong, could be against Masorah, could be mistake, could lead to all sorts of things. It doesn't mean they're usser. Usser means you're sinning. You have to do tshuva. Lots of things could be bad, wrong things, mistaken things without being usser. So the Rav could think that being in the Board of Rabbis, in his opinion, look, the Rav, it's class, in this book, at the end, after going through, what is this, 80 pages, explaining his view about the state of Israel, it's how you should regard it, all the things about Yom HaTzimut, and what does it say in the last paragraph? Whatever I said, don't consider them as Piskei Halacha. I'm not a Poski. I'm just sharing my thoughts with you. If you feel I'm wrong, I won't be offended. In other words, he's saying it's not a psak, it's not advice. I'm just thinking aloud. The Rav's telling you his opinion. And if you choose not to follow it, he's not going to say you're sinning. It's you're a show, you're a fool, maybe. You could be a fool, but it's not usser. Marty says, sorry if this is simplistic. Isn't the Rav considered the ultimate posek of Orthodox Zionists? So how can Orthodox Zionim minyanim say hello and you must move if the Rav was against it? Are there other examples the non-Orthodox disagree on the Rav's ruling? Well, we spoke about it the last class. So the Rav would oppose this prayer for the state of Israel the way we have it. Reishis Smicha Gulotenu. But in America, when this became the accepted practice in the 50s, the Rav was a Rosh Hashiva, respected, but he didn't have the influence he has today. The chief rabbinate of Israel, that's where people are looking to. It's the same thing. The Rav is not the final posek on these matters. A whole tradition developed about how to celebrate Yom HaTzimut before the Rav became the dominant figure he is today. And people are not giving that up just because the Rav. So the Rav is great, but not all the practices in America follow the Rav. He has, in his minion, Maimonides, they follow. But I thank you for coming out. I hope we were able to get your mind
here,
a little bit
Doc.
About the difficulties that we're now going to see in the days ahead. But Torah, as it says, v'lomod, we have to. And it's the Eitz Chaim. You know, they look for death. They're a death cult. It's a death cult, basically. They want to meet Allah, so God willing, our people will send them to Allah. But it's a death cult, and we're a life cult. We believe in life. Everything's about life. And God willing, life will triumph over the death that they worship. Rabbi Kalman.
Thank you. Yeah, I just got the last few minutes. I mean, I must say I was, I don't know if you mentioned I was coming from the rally here in Toronto for the Sport of Israel. It was very, very beautifully done. I must say the prime minister of the country spoke, the premier of Ontario, the mayor of Toronto, Orthodox conservative rabbi each gave a tefillah, the head of UJ. I don't know, those who know the community in Toronto knows it's a very well organized community that sort of the UJ umbrella federation. I'm just saying, with thousands of people there, and it was very nice. So whatever, it's awful, the situation, of
very
course.
Shy, that's what we just said here.
I'm sorry,
very shy, that's what we just said. Very shy.
Yes,
what we just
what
said
the Rav said about giving an Orthodox rabbi together with a conservative rabbi.
No, I think it was very beautiful. They had the rabbis of the basically the leading Reform shul, the rabbi of Shir Shemaim. I think Rabbi Rabbi Karofkin probably would have done, he was away, so Rabbi Taylor from Sher Shemaim, Rabbi Splansky from Holy Blossom, and Rabbi Flassenreich from Beth Shalom. These names may not mean anything to people, but they're in Toronto. But three large shuls, and one said a tefillah l'shalom ha-medina, one said Achenu Kol Beit Yisrael. He actually sang it. That was the Orthodox rabbi. Yeah. He had 1,000 people. Achenu Kol Beit Yisrael. Very moving. And then the conservative rabbi did Kamalei Rachamim. And
I actually think the Rav would have supported something like that because correct, we saw correct. He was opposed internally. But remember, we saw when they had the tercentenary for the public thing, when the Congress people were going to come, the Rav said, we can't see the public square. So on a thing like this, when all the Jews are coming together for no Orthodox spokesman to be there, I think the Rav...
Yeah, no, it is very... I mean, Anna Minsky, who's the head of a federation here in Toronto, basically set up, you know, we're a very diverse community, but tonight it doesn't matter if we're Ashkenazic, Sephardic, religious, secular, liberal, left-wing, right-wing, you know, all the Narishkeit with all the protests and judicial frame. He didn't say that, but that we're one. And that's it was very nice. Like, you know, thousands or, you know, hundreds for sure of Israeli flags waving. And then at the end, they ended up with singing Oseh Shalom and Hatikva. They had all the leaders from various political parties from all levels of the municipal, provincial, and federal government, cabinet ministers, the premier. So in that sense, and it was very, what can I say? That's what we can do here right now. The world, thank God, is behind us, you know, unequivocally in support. It's that we know, but what can I say? We should hear good news, but I think it is important. It's chizuk, and for the people in Israel, they had a film for, like, they have the Shin Shanim, the people who come for a year after high school. There are 22 of them on stage, and, you know, and they had a film. They interviewed Toronto people who are in Israel now. Like, they put it together, obviously, very quickly. You know, that what it means to them. So it's an tragic, you know, everybody knows people in the army, and lots of people know people who were killed already. And it's very unfortunate. So let's hear good news. So anyways, that's why I was late. But we did think, you know, it's important. All teachers agree we'll continue learning, and in the school, the learning, we should have yeshuot v'nechamot, and we should hear good things, and everybody can do what they do. Tshuva, tefila, utzdaka. I spoke, if I may, you know, I spoke over Yontif. I think we have to be machmir on Jewish unity. I think that's the chumrah of our generation. We want to be machmir on Jewish unity. And Jewish unity means Orthodox, conservative, Reform, secular, everybody. We don't have to agree, but we have to be united. We can't, whatever, not that time to discuss. But anyway,
earlier, when you listen to the tape, you'll hear the Rav distinguishes Klapei Panim and
Klapei Chutz. Yes, I know, of course.
And that's...
yes, of course. Listen, that's about, there was, that's for sure. Anyways, I know they're having a rally in New York tomorrow at the UN, so I don't know. Hopefully they'll be well attended and whatever. Okay.
The problem is tomorrow at the UN, you're going to have something else that you maybe didn't have. You're going to have people out there with flags, Palestinian flags, basically cheering. Look, we had people who supported the Nazis, basically modern day Nazis. You're going to have there screaming, correct, bloodthirsty, and it's unbelievable going on in the
chief of. A police was that. Beside all, the first people they thanked is our police force. You know, they were out in full force. They blocked the streets all surrounding. And it's like in sort of the square, Mel Lastman Square, whatever, downtown North York. It's sort of a, whatever. You can get thousands of people there. So they blocked off the streets. They told people there'll be no parking, not to drive. We actually walked. It's an hour walk from our house and whatever. But, anyway, so what can you say? There are people who are, unfortunately, who celebrate. That's a terrible thing, but we have to be strong and come together. Okay. But Rabbi Shulman will be giving, that's the next class, we'll be giving his Kohelet class tomorrow at 1 p.m. And Shuli Mishkin will be starting her series at 1 p.m. on Wednesday. And Thursday night, Parsha Shir will be Elliot Schreier, Rabbi Elliot Schreier of B'nai Shurun in Teaneck, and I'll be giving, please God, the sitter, on Friday morning. So wish everybody well. We should hear good news, and the Jewish people should be strong, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give us Yeshuot v'Nachama. Be well, everybody. Laila Tov.